We're learning Rav Dessler's work, Michtav Mediyahu. I started in the last class just to say over a bit of the biography of Rabbi Dessler to put us in the picture, and then we'll be doing the text inside the text. We'll be going through it line by line. I'll be reading and translating. He spoke about the earlier years of his life until around about 1927, 26, 27, he came to England, where he was serving in a very modest, very unpublic, a very private role of a rov of a shul in London, as well as, which was his main concern, was the students that he was training. However, there was a big change the minute the Second World War broke out, and that is when he took on a huge, that's really the turning point in his life. That's when he took on this huge yoke, which really changed his whole life for himself and for us, for the whole Jewish people, because of the person he became under the challenge that met him. Just before the war, his wife and his daughter traveled to Lithuania to visit their son, who was in yeshiva. They had sent his son there a few years earlier at the age of 15 to Lithuania, and the minute that the war started, they were stuck in Europe, and that's it. They were stuck for the rest of the war. He didn't see them for the rest of the war, the entire period. Now, someone who wouldn't know him would not have been able to imagine his pain. He was very much attached to his family, but he wasn't a person to show his sadness on his face. There is a teaching of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter that a person's face is like a public domain. So just like you don't drop litter in the streets, because the streets is for everyone, it's not your private street, you don't litter the streets. So similarly, you shouldn't show a sad expression or a very upset expression on your face, because your face is also public domain. Everyone sees your face. So who are you to go and make other people miserable by walking around with a long face? This is a teaching of Rav Yisrael Salanter. Your face is like public property. Your private feelings are private, but what's on your face? So therefore, he never showed his personal pain. He was a person, a very, very sensitive person, and therefore he did feel pain, but he kept it to himself. And on the contrary, he made an effort to comfort other people who were in pain. He was there to comfort. He was the one who was always the one who was consoling others, as opposed to looking for consolation for himself. Eventually, the story is that they escaped from Europe. His son escaped together with the yeshiva, escaped to the States, and his wife and daughter ended up in Australia for the remainder of the war. But for the whole war, he was by himself. Now we'll see how that was important for the work that he took on. That he had that freedom, that special freedom, which by being free of his family, that was allowed to him. At the same time, also in the way of the Gedolim, he felt tremendous pain for Klal Yisrael. Right? Like the story with the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim wouldn't sleep in his bed during the First World War. He slept on our bench. He said, "I have the Jewish young men in the trenches. How can I lie in a bed?" And therefore, he refused the entire period of the war to sleep in a bed. So the same thing, Rav Dessler felt a tremendous pain for the Jewish people. And one of the main questions that used to bother him was, he asked, well, how come we're, interesting question, because the exact opposite of what many people asked, how come Hashem left us alive? Right? You know, the whole of Europe was going up in flames and millions of Jews were being killed. So why is it Hashem has left us alive? What special reason does Hashem have? You know, this little corner of England where the Jews are being saved from the Holocaust. What is the special purpose? That was a question that bothered him until 1941, Tavshin Aleph. He received the answer to this question. The answer came in the form of a letter from a Rav David Ryan. Rav David Ryan was one of the founders of the community in Gateshead. Gateshead was quite a unique community because it was like quite a poor town, a working town. But it was a corner of England where there were very few secular Jews there. They hadn't arrived there, secular Jews. They hadn't opened up their businesses there. And it became a small corner for totally frum Jews. Jews of Haredisha Jews who had this very small community in Gateshead. So this Rav David Ryan wrote to Rav Des, and he said he wants to open a koilo, which was quite a revolutionary idea in those times. He wants to open a koilo for Avreichim of excellent, outstanding Bnei Torah, who were scattered in England, that they should have a place to go where they're going to be supported, and they'll be able to sit and learn instead of taking on jobs. So this was the challenge that he sent to Rav Desler. Obviously, he's also asking Rav Desler to not only just to run it, to fundraise. You know, basically, it was a suggestion: you do all the work, just come here and do it here in Gateshead. He had there also in Gateshead was Rav Naftali Shakovitsky. Those who knew Rav Mordechai Shakovitsky in Yerushalayim was Rav Naftali's son. He was the Rav of the town, and he was one of the Talmidim of the Chofetz Chaim. He was there also as a support. So he had these people who were encouraging him, and he took this on. He took on this challenge of setting up a koilo. It was really really like a dream. It was a fantasy, this koilo, because those people who potentially could support the koilo, they had all scattered because of the bombs falling on London. So everyone ran or disappeared into the villages, and they were scattered all over England. It was, you know, almost impossible to find the few people who could help him financially. Were very hard to find, to access such people. So therefore, the yeshivas themselves, there was tremendous poverty in those times, and he still got this fantastic dream. He's going to set up a koil, he's going to start supporting Younger Light. Also, there was another obstacle, a huge obstacle was the Jews in England also were very ignorant of Torah outlook, Torah values. They hardly knew what a Ben Yeshiva is. A student to sit in Yeshiva, you know, why should a certain student sit in Yeshiva? If he's going to be a rabbi, okay, let him study in Yeshiva. But we don't need that many rabbis, so, you know, let the rest of them go to work. What are they doing sitting in Yeshiva? So Yeshivas, they didn't understand. Certainly the idea of a koilal, a married man, wowee, a married man's going to sit and learn, and, you know, how's he going to support himself? So that was a totally foreign idea for many, many Jews. He had to basically try and sell an idea that no one even knew about. So therefore, nevertheless, he took on the responsibility that he's going to do it. And it's what also made it surprising was he personally was a very private person, a very modest person, and therefore he wasn't used to public work. He wasn't used to, you know, going speaking to people, etc. It wasn't his approach. It wasn't his style. Also, he was already at the age of this. He was already at the age of 50 at this point. He'd already reached the age of 50. Imagine life starts at 50. You know, this is now. He took on this whole new thing. He was not such a youngster. He wasn't so healthy either. He also had health issues. Even so, there was a decision made that they're going to try and save these. There were students who'd come from Europe who'd learnt in yeshivas. These students had been forced to take on jobs. Some of them were taking on jobs of to be a rabbonim of shuls, but that obviously would have taken them out of learning. And these students themselves wanted to get back to learning somehow. Somehow to get back to learning. This is what they wanted to facilitate. Another rationale also, which was important, that he said, you know, if the whole of Europe's going up in smokes, so we have rabbonim at the moment, but who are going to be our rabbonim in 20 years' time? Who are going to be our poiskim? Who are going to be the generation leaders in 20 years' time if we don't have any way of nurturing the young talent that we have in the present times? So all of this was the rationale behind opening up a koilo. Also, as we mentioned, the fact that his wife wasn't there. One of his issues, though, what happens to his students in London? Right? Does he just abandon them? He can't abandon them. He started training them. He had these small groups of younger students that he was working with. And he understood an idea. There's a principle that the weaker the students, the greater greatness is required to really try and save them. He understood that it's not, you know, it's, you know, sometimes to more senior students, everyone wants to be their teacher. But when it comes to the younger students, right, try and nurture the younger students. So this was something that was a special responsibility. In any event, he took on the task. As we mentioned, this was a turning point, and it basically included running the koilel in Gateshead, both in terms of financially and spiritually, giving classes to the koilel, also the running of the actual organization of the running of the koilel itself, as well as to continue. He decided he's not giving up his students in London, he was going to commute. which is a tremendous commute, and especially in war times, and you know, it was all by train. It was a tremendously long train journeys. He's going to do it all, and this is what he took on, and he's going to do them up. And he did this for about 4 to 5 years, right till the end of the war and a little bit after the war. Basically, the whole responsibility of the Kodal Gates, the Gates at Kodal, was on his shoulders. His weekly schedule was 2 or 3 days in London. The beginning of the week, he had his students. A few of them were private students who paid him. Some of them were paid him, because from the Kodal, he decided from the start he's not taking a cent from the Kodal. Even though he's raising all the funds, he did not take a salary from the Kodal. He did it totally voluntarily. So therefore, the few students he had was to support himself, as well as to try and send money. He used to send money to his family in Europe. Then there were at that point, Tuesday, Wednesday, he was already traveling to Gateshead, and he was there for Shabbos. After Shabbos, he would travel back, but he'd go via Manchester. Also, some students there, also collecting money. So therefore, it was a tremendously full week. At the same time, he travelled at night, which sort of saved him time. And then he was also available to all sorts of questions. People used to come to him with all sorts of questions, questions about chinuch and panos and shiduchim. He was a very, very pleasant person, extremely pleasant person, very easy to speak to, very, very gracious. Anyone who came to him with a question who came to ask him, he always had time for everybody. Also, he answered, he wrote many, many letters. Everything was letters in those days. No phone. Well, the phones was not such an easy option. So he wrote, he has the hundreds and hundreds of letters recorded that have been kept of his works. So basically, he was a mother to many, many students scattered throughout the land. At the same time, he was also writing new Torah. He already had many, many teachings that he'd already accumulated, but he never used his old teachings. He said, no, if he's got an opportunity to learn, so he's going to learn new material, and he's going to explore new material. And that's what he did, tremendously deep material, which, please God, we'll be seeing soon, in terms of Agadas, explaining the Agadat, the homiletic side of the Talmud, and also Zohar, ideas in Kabbalah, and also ideas in Koichas HaNefesh, hidden strengths of the human personality, which is very much what Musa deals with. Musa deals with uncovering the strength people have, to which they're able to bring out of themselves. And a person has unbelievable abilities, sometimes they're totally untapped, and really Musa addresses these topics to try and help a person discover them and bring them out for himself. At the same time, he was considered to be like almost a simple person. He didn't assume any airs. People who knew him just treated him like a regular person. When you look about it at his story, the whole thing's amazing, but people who knew him just thought, you know, everything he did with a tremendous amount of simplicity. The rules that he set up for the Kohelel was that all the students they accepted in the Kohelel, they started off with 5 students, and eventually within a year it had doubled to 10, and it grew. The group progressively. The conditions were that they all were supported honorably. Each one was given a dwelling, a place to live, a panosa, that he could live comfortably. The condition was no jobs. You can't take on any side jobs. You can't even teach students. Like, if you do want to teach students without being paid, you can do so after Kohelel times, which is after 10 at night. Up till 10 at night, they were still part of the Kohelel. And thereafter, if they wanted to take on private students, they were able to do so. Okay, also one of the ideas that he took on himself was not to fall into debt. Right? That's one of the big hazards of someone who runs a institution, is the expenses amount. So he says, well, he'll borrow some money, he'll borrow, and that's one of the big pitfalls, that people fall into tremendous debt and they can't pay it back. So he decided he's not taking on any debt at all, he's going to pay for everything. So sometimes the end of the week would come, and he'd have no money. So he'd go collecting money at the last minute, and he says there were miracles that Hashem actually helped him. You see, sometimes if you decide you're going to do something, there's special heavenly help that you're able to accomplish anything that you try to. And one of the ideas he spoke out, this I'm going to read to you from his actual words, he asked the question, how can a person who's so simple as me, who's so unimportant as me, how can he have such amazing heavenly help? How is it possible that I received in this task of mine such amazing heavenly help. So I'm going to read from his words as follows. He says like this, Yesh zeche la'alois ma'asois ha'maisim l'male mi'madregosi. There are those who merit that they're able to do things beyond their own personal spiritual level. They can do things that really are beyond them. Right? The heavens give them the merit to do things beyond them. Al yedei schuyos she'ein en loy. Merits that don't belong to them. Someone who's working for the betterment of the world around him. So he receives a heavenly help way beyond what is his normal level. And this is on condition that he takes on such tasks in good faith, in trust in Hashem, and also with a drive towards the truth. In other words, there's a striving to do the right thing. So then there's a special heavenly help to such a person. And then, with the right intentions, and this is really the key, with the right intentions, so then he has the merits to have wonderful success. Someone who is needed, where there is a job to be done, but the world needs something done. Right, we're talking about the Jewish world, the Torah world, and even though there's no one, even though he personally is not fit to do the job, but the job has to be done. So even though the person himself is not fit to do this job, since there's no one else who can, or there's no one else who wants to, could be there are people who can do certain tasks, but they're not so interested in doing, they don't want to, they don't want the extra yoke, the extra the headache. So since there's no one else who can, or there's no one else who wants to, and that's the key here, because if you don't want something, Hashem doesn't push you into something you don't want to do. Our lives are determined by us and our own personal desires. We have to want something and then we can strive towards it. We can't strive to something we don't want. We can't. You know, spirituality cannot, a person cannot grow spiritually without a desire to grow in that direction. So therefore, since there's no one else to do this job, the person merits all of that heavenly help which the situation calls for, even though he personally doesn't merit to have such miracles in his life or such help in his life, but the situation calls for miracles and those miracles will happen. So therefore he says, in our very impoverished generation, our main job is to try and rebuild what was destroyed. Right, the different desolations of the in terms of Torah and service of Hashem. So that's our main work. There's been such tremendous destruction, and we have to somehow try and save whatever's able to save. Right, they're refugees from this tremendous Holocaust, and therefore it's our job to try and build and try and repair as much as possible. And even though in our own lowliness we're not really fit to take on such exalted work, we call Mokam Achashain Mishiyama the Peretz Beladeinu, since there's no one else who's going to take on such a mission, who's going to stand in the Peretz. A Peretz is a hole in the wall. And when there's a hole in the wall, so everything flows out, like a hole in the bottom of the bucket. The hole in the bucket, so therefore the bucket doesn't hold any. So where there's a hole, where there's a big gap, there's a gap in the Jewish people. So whoever's going to prepare to stand there in that gap and trying to stop the destruction, right, or something, right? He's going to take on such a task. He will receive on the day receives huge heavenly help. So basically, that's how he defined himself. In his humility, he didn't think of himself as very much of a great person, but he did have this heavenly help, and we just look at it from outside. The Kollel had also wonderful success in terms of the whole town of Gateshead. The Gateshead Seminary basically is an outgrowth of the Kollel that he started. The Gateshead Seminary is very, very famous. And also there's a boarding school. And he was able to sort of encourage those people who eventually headed up those organizations through his work. Basically, he was also looking to get the Kollel running by itself. He worked very hard. He took on the total responsibility, but he always looked... He didn't act like he's the boss, right? I'm the boss of this. This is my organization. I'm the bala boss. I own it all. It's me. He always regarded himself as just a person, one on the sidelines, who just happened to be helping along. Right, just helping to, right? But he was willing and happy to have other people take over responsibility and to take over the kodel, which is eventually what happened. Okay, that takes us up to the end of the war. At the end of the war, there was another change. Right, shortly after the war, the tremendous efforts he made during the war left him totally exhausted, totally depleted. And also, his health, as we mentioned, wasn't the best. And at this point, there came in a new invitation, which was to come to Eretz Yisrael and to join the Ponovitch Yeshiva of Kahneman, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Ponovitch, which was one of still today is one of the major yeshivas, but then it was basically the mother yeshiva of all the yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael, invited him to come to be the Mashgiach in Ponovitch. He took on this job with certain conditions. One of them is that he doesn't abandon his students in England. He would still travel to England every so often to give, you know, to help them and to advise them and to be there for them. But basically, he and his wife moved to Eretz Yisrael, and it was a different type of work. Here, he had quiet. He was able to work on his essays to a large degree. Spent much, much time. And he put tremendous effort into these. We should know that the writings we have here, and this is the success of these writings, why these writings have been so accepted by the Jewish people, is because they're brilliant. They're totally brilliant. And the brilliance comes from the amazing effort, right? There was no laziness. He explored these topics with tremendous diligence. And he used to spend hours and hours and hours examining and checking and learning out the topic. He was given also quite a big yoke. He was already giving 3 major classes per week. Each of them required a tremendous preparation, matters of Musa and Koichas HaNefesh, as we mentioned. And he would spend up to sometimes 25 hours preparing a single class, right? That the class should come out, that he should be able to get over his message in the best possible way. So maybe a class only lasts for an hour, but there was 25 hours of preparation before a class. Also, that shows the tremendous efforts that he put into it. Okay, we mentioned that he was still concerned about his students in England. He also traveled to the States. His son and his daughter also moved to the States. His son was in the state in Cleveland by the Tel Shiva, and he was traveling there as well. In 1951, his wife passed away, quite young, right, early 60s. He continued the work in Yerushalayim, in Bnei Brak, and also he used to travel to Yerushalayim, give shiurim in Yerushalayim. Became very popular at a certain point. People used to, busloads used to come to hear his classes, and there was a tremendous flowering. And then eventually in 1954, approximately, he became very ill. It was shortly after the passing away of the Chazon Ish. Rav Dessler passed away 2 months after the Chazon Ish. He was there at the Levaya of the Chazon Ish. He felt tremendous pain, but he forced himself not to leave the Levaya, and he accompanied the Aaron of the Chazon Ish. Shortly afterwards, he fell very sick, and he passed away. The tier was Chof Hei Tevis, which is right about now, in the year 1954. At that point, he was 62. That was when he passed away. His students were there at his deathbed. All of these are, you know, famous names. Later became famous names. And he was tremendously sick. And then just before he passed away, he opened his eyes and he smiled. And then he passed away. Right. His son was, as we mentioned, in Cleveland. He left a son in Cleveland, and his daughter married Geltzeller, who was part of the Beis Midrash Elyon in Spring Valley and also in the States. Schussi again, Ali. Okay, let's start the first essay. The first essay is called Chaya Oisha, A Happy Life, Happy Living, and it's from a letter he wrote to his son in 1938. His son was learning was a young student in Lithuania, and this is the letter, right? This is the essay. Okay, the essay starts as follows. Chaya Oisha Bo'ilam Hazeh. A happy life in this world. A happy life in this world. Mi lo yoda biu gimel milim elu. Who doesn't understand these 3 words? Right? A happy life in this world. Who isn't the person who thinks about having a good life in this world? The question is though, Ma'wa Oisha Bo'ilam Hazeh. What is happiness in this world? lechayra lepashatu. Seemingly, this is a very simple question. Kizeh asher yuchal lasig es kol asher yachpoitz hu amusha. Whoever can reach whatever he wants, he's able to acquire whatever he wants. Whatever he desires, he has the ability to get whatever he wants. So that is the happy person. If he needs it, he can buy it and he can acquire it and he has it. So therefore, that seemingly is the definition of a person who's happy. Right? And then we understand as a simple thing so that someone who is good at doing business and he's very talented in business, right? He knows how to, he's a good trader, he's a good dealer and wheeler and dealer, right? And he's able, and he's able to gather great wealth together, so he's the happy person, you know, he's the one who's made it. That's how you say this person has made it. He's able to, accumulates wealth, and he's able to buy whatever he needs and whatever he wants. So he is the happy person. And whoever is more ambitious and more diligent, right? You have these hard-working people. You have, you know, we know this. We know that the people in the business world who work 18-hour days is a simple thing. You know, that's just a regular day is an 18-hour day, and they're very, very bright, and they're very sharp, and they're very clever, right? Clever minds. So the who needs there sheyeshlo hakoiches anidroshes. So this is the person who has the talents needed to reach happiness in this world, because he has the ability to amass the wealth and to he's able to supply, provide his family with all that they want. So that seemingly is the key to happiness. Right, we always hear stories of people of this world, right? People, successful people of this world. And how much they're praised for being ambitious, right? Ambition is considered one of, oh, this is an ambitious, you know, this is a go-getter, this is an ambitious person, right? You say about certain children or certain youngsters, oh, this person is very ambitious. That certainly is a key to success, right? If he's ambitious, so then that's what's going to be the key. And therefore, someone who's not ambitious, everyone looks down at him. This person's a good for nothing, he has no ambitions, he doesn't try to do anything. So this really, you know, you just give up hope on such people, right? He's a butlan, he's a good for nothing. Amnon came, and so it seems to be. If we look carefully, if we look for a systematic way, exactly, and we ask the question, we have to ask a different question. We have to ask, do we know, right, if we start, let's start in a systematic way. If we start asking the question, do we know of happy people in this world? Right? Do we know someone who's happy in this world? Now, what's important is as follows. If you'll ask other people, if they know of other people who are happy in this world, and as you ask certain people about other people, if they know of other people who are happy in this world, right? People say yes. If you ask people, do you know of happy people in this world? Yeah, for sure, I know of people who are happy in this world. No, not me, but I know other people. I know people who are very, very happy in this world, right? To us also it appears to be so. We see people and we assume that they're very happy. Certainly amongst wealthy people there are unfortunates. We know that certainly amongst them are unfortunates, the miserable people. There are amongst the millionaires who have bitter lives, who eat bitter herbs as their daily fare. However, we also see with our own eyes that amongst them are very people who appear to be extremely happy. Right? Maybe there are a few exceptions of miserable people, but the rest of them all look like they're very happy. We see the houses they live in, we see the food they eat, the food and the drink, and their servants, the way their mode of transport, right? They travel by plane, and they travel by helicopter, and they travel by limousine. Right? The gold they have, and the silver they have, the precious gems they have, the jewels. So certainly such people, if they don't suffer some sort of personal tragedy in their lives, Vada Mushorim Hemo, certainly we would say that these are happy people. However, this is very superficial. Right? Just to look at them superficially and to say, and therefore, since everything looks so wonderful on the outside, therefore they must be happy, is a very superficial way of looking at such people. We want to really check this out in a systematic way. There's only one path before us. We have to go amongst these people. We have to ask them. Right? Not to ask one about his friend. Don't ask A about B. Don't ask B about C. Let's ask Mr. A about himself. Let's ask B about himself. Let's ask these people about themselves. Let us ask them personally. Then we'll know for sure. Not that they appear to be happy on the outside. Let's ask them if they're actually happy people. If they are happy people, who have, you know, have whatever they want from life. Of our manimtzas, what will we find if we do ask them themselves? We ask them personally, privately, right? Directly. Right? Natskil Ishol is Piashi. We'll start with the richest people. Eila Shekesev to us for them. We people who have just money pouring out of their pockets. Ashizov Yashlichu Bukhutsis Ravko, right? They're able to scatter their gold in the streets. They have so much of it. They just keep writing checks for everyone and handing out cash to everyone. If we find such people, Eila Sheba Moinus Yaduru Bamachonius Hayusin and Daris, so these are people who live in palaces and travel in the most expensive motor cars. Mayanu Lonu Kol Echod Mem. What will these people say to us? Right? If we actually ask them, what will they say to us? They will say the following: Lo bonu ha oishev lo lonu. Right, happiness is not ours. Happiness is not our lot. Hey lo oishev zachinu ba'ain ra. Right, yes, it's true we merited wealth. Oshe, the word oshe means wealth. Or with an ayin. Right, the ayin with the eye. Ayin is the letter ayin is also the eye. The ayin hora, right? The evil eye, the jealous eyes that look at such people with resentment. It's true we have oisha with an ayin, achala oisha with an aleph, oisha with an aleph, which is happiness, lo zachinu adan, we don't have that. Zebo bekinosa, this one has his competition, he's upset by the rivalry of his competition. Zebo taivosa, right, Rav Adams, who comes to Kiryat Sefer occasionally, once told me a story of a wealthy man that he knows. He went to a car dealer and he wanted a certain imported car that no one in the town has such a car. That he wants to be the only person in town with this particular imported model. That he's going to be totally unique. So anyway, finally he ordered his car, he got his car. A week later he sees a person with a very long face. He says, what's the problem? He says, there's another one. Someone else ordered the same model. Yeah? One person with his jealousy, with the rivalry, his competitiveness, right, one-upmanship. Right, keeping up with the Joneses and surpassing the Joneses and putting the Joneses to shame. Zebra type, also one with his lusts, with his different hang-ups, with his different desires. Right, whatever you give him is not good enough. Whatever, he's not happy with what he has. Rubam ra lehem, the base, many have shalom bayis problems. Right, is it bad for them in their homes? Their homes are terrible. Sorry, mishpachot, family troubles. Right, kids going off the path and all sorts of family troubles, divorces, etc. Tzoris bonus, right? Problematic boys and girls. Tzoris koldova sheyetzalem. All types of troubles. You see, the truth is, no one lives a trouble-free life. Right? No, there's no such thing. There's no person who doesn't have troubles in his life. It's just part of the formula. We're in this world, and Hashem sends us tzoris, and the tzoris themselves are our challenges. And that's what our lives are about, overcoming challenges. That's exactly what you're like. That's what you're here to do. We're not here on vacation, right? We're here to do a job of work. And therefore, everyone has tzoros, and they also have tzoros. Everyone has tzoros. There's no one who's exempt, right? And by them, you see, their problem is that they expect not to have tzoros. They expect, since we're wealthy, we should not have tzoros. And what do they see? It's their wealth itself is the source of problem, right? But tzoros, let's study, say, in the Elamineu Bay. They find that the wealth itself that they have is itself the source of all their headaches and problems. right? Because of their wealth, on account of their wealth. Because we know there's a teaching of Koheles, a person does not die without ever reaching half of his desires. A person can never reach half of what he wants. Right? As much as you have, you always want more than double than what you have. Right? So therefore, sometimes the richer person, the more miserable he is. Because if a person has $100, so he wants 200. So how much is he short? He's short 100, right? A person's got $200. How much does he want? He wants 400. So how much is he short? He's short $200. The more you have, the more you're short. The more you need, the more needy you become, because you can never reach half of what you want in terms of the satisfactions of this world. And if so, wealth is not amongst these. These are not, we're asking the wrong people. These people are not the happy people of the world. They're not the happy ones. Let's try asking other types of people. Right? The very wealthy are not the happy people of the world. Let's ask middle class. Middle class, suburbia, right? The accountants and the lawyers and the doctors. Let's speak to them if they have succeeded. Right? Let's ask them if they're the happy people of the world. Let's ask them if they're happy. We find they work very hard, a lot of work. The kasha leman harbis kis, right? They're working hard. They're also amassing wealth. They're also making savings and saving money and working towards their wealth. Namda nak regnisiashivulai behema oishamiti. Maybe these are the happy people. They don't have the headache of these huge fortunes, but maybe they are. Maybe they've reached the balance. Maybe they are the people who have the balance of happiness in this world. Here we find, to our great surprise, all their lives they're busy, and they don't have time to enjoy their lives. They're just working all the time to prepare it. They're in preparation mode. They're preparing. They're amassing. So when will they have the time to be free, to enjoy their, and to be happy, to enjoy their wealth? They never reach that time. They never reach that time, and they can just sit back and enjoy the fruits of their hard labors. Right, when they finally, they become old, and they retire, and then they're at the gates of death. Suddenly find they're totally unimportant. Right? All his life he was working and he was important. He was the big doctor, he was the specialist, he was the advisor. And all of a sudden he's retired and he finds that he's useless. And he's to feel, there's the frustration of just not having reached what he was working towards. And this is not what he wanted. This retirement is not what he wanted. They're used to being in the working world. And now they don't have the strength to work anymore. They find that their lives are meaningless, tasteless, without taste, no meaning to their lives. And they're a shadow of the original selves. This is how they look at themselves. They're just ghosts. They're not real people. They're not alive anymore once they retire. So while they're working, they're busy working all the time. And once they stop working, so then they feel at a loss that they don't have their work anymore. Okay, so therefore our middle class is not the solution. Let's go down a lower level. Let's go down to the working class. Maybe these guys know how to live it up. Maybe they have the happy life. Those who are working constantly with the labors of their hands, the labors of their... Maybe they are the ones who are happy. Let's ask them. They work very hard every day. Sometimes they have night shifts as well. But if we ask them, we'll find that they feel that their share of this world is the smallest of them all. They're full of resentment. Everyone is getting rich on their backs, right? They're getting paid pennies, and the bosses and the managers are all profiting at their expense. They're the happy ones with the big wallets, and we are the ones who are the downtrodden, the miserable ones. And they feel that the wealthy people have taken all of the wealth which rightfully belongs to them at their expense. They're the workers. They bring all the goodness, all the wealth into this world, but they get none of it for themselves. Others have robbed them. They're victims. They've been robbed. Society has robbed them. So are these people happy? Certainly no. They're certainly not happy. The imkain, and if so, right, we've gone through all three tiers of society. Where is happy life in this world? Right? Where is the happy life in this world? This is our question. And no one can supply an answer, seemingly. No one seemingly can say about himself, yes, I've struck the right formula. I'm the happy person in this world. Right? The echo that we hear through the world is a happy life. There's no such thing. Right, so you'll hear that, right, these are the punts and the critics and the skeptics and the all the bright ones, the intelligent ones. They'll say happy life in this world, no such thing. This is a very clear thing. Once you clarify all issues, all people, all, right, everyone's working towards something. No one reaches what they really want. They live for a certain dream, and no one reaches the dream. No one is happy in this world. Imkain, and if that's the case, so if the answer is that there are no happy people in this world, no one is happy. So haloi nishal, we have another question to ask, and the question is, Mazi Asa Kodesh Boku. What has Hashem done? Shebor Ulam Godel Leman Shakol Mama Shakol Yisbelu Yisurim Roim Gedolim. Why should Hashem have created this huge, wonderful, magnificent world where everyone, literally everyone, is suffering from agonies and pain and afflictions and a terrible lifestyle? So what has Hashem done? And He's set up a world that everyone's miserable. So what sort of world do we have here? Haloi gam ze iefshahu. So that's also impossible. That also cannot be right. You know, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in His genius, has created such a brilliant world, the world is totally brilliant, right? The workings of the world, just the nature of the world itself. Human nature, so deep, it's so wondrous, it's so brilliant, such genius in this world. How can it be that Hashem has set up this whole world that everyone should be miserable in it? Everyone should, you know, you make a party, and all your guests should come to your party, and they should all be miserable. that's the purpose of making a party, right? With a band and with the catering and everything, that everyone should come and everyone should be miserable. That doesn't make sense, right? It's impossible. Im ken haloi boru sheyesh tikun lera hazeh. If so, there must be a remedy to this evil and this terrible tragedy which has occurred to the whole world. Everyone is suffering. There must be some formula which is a remedy to this tragedy. And it's for us to search out what would be the remedy. Are we looking for a worldwide remedy for this problem? For this problem to correct what's wrong? How do we find happiness? Everyone wants happiness, right? Ask anyone. Yeah, sure, I want to be happy. So where's the place where you find happiness? Certainly Hashem, who is all goodness, and who is the source of all goodness. Any goodness that exists is all from Hashem. He's the source of it all. So if there is goodness in the world, it comes from Him. He is the source of all goodness. So must be He prepared it, He readied it for His guests. He set up a world. We're guests in Hashem's world. It must be, it exists in this world. It must be, it's here. Right? The source of happiness for everyone must be, it's here. It can't be otherwise. Hashem is all goodness. So for sure, he's made the world in the best possible way. And therefore, before we can know this remedy, we must first see what is the problem. So let's say we're looking for the remedy, but before we look for the remedy, let's look what the problem is. What is the problem? Why are most people miserable? What is their problem? What's bothering them? What's upsetting them? What is the reason for the problem that's resulting in this global unhappiness, dissatisfaction? Only a doctor who has diagnosed the sickness can prescribe a prescription, right? A doctor can't give you a prescription with medication unless he first knows what's wrong with you. And therefore, this is our task also. What is wrong with the world? What is wrong with the people of the world? There's nothing wrong with the world, but what's wrong with the people in the world that they're all so miserable? And therefore, once we find out the problem, maybe we can try and look for a remedy. What is that spoiling? What's rotten in this world that's spoiling happiness for us in this life? So please, God, we'll go on with this in the next class.